Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hey, I'm Brian Stelter, live in New York, and this is Reliable Sources, where we examine the story behind the story and we figure out what's reliable. First, the never-ending argument over abortion access. Here are two New York Times front pages, side by side. 1973, Supreme Court rules abortion legal in the first 3 months. Then 2022, the same ruling overturned. 49 years of fights and prayers and medical advances and societal changes. And I'm left wondering, what will the front pages say in another 49 years? Will we be in the same conversation? Well, one difference between 1973 and today is the real-time data that we have. Searches for the word abortion were especially high this week in metro areas like Madison, Wisconsin, Kansas City, Missouri, and Salt Lake City, Utah, areas where the procedure is now banned. This weekend, Google searches for the question, can I get an abortion, are over-indexing in those states where it is now illegal. Missouri, Wisconsin, Kentucky, Arkansas, Oklahoma, all at the top of the Google Trends data. And Axios reports that the top queries related to abortion right now include, is it illegal, abortion ban states, and abortion pill. Yes, searches for abortion pill are highest right now in red states, including some that have already banned abortion and others that are likely to follow. So this data, it's important. It provides an insight into what people are searching for in the privacy of their own homes, and it's buttressed by local reporting showing the impacts of the bans. It's critical right now to have reporters in states telling these stories. Quote, the end of Roe v. Wade is one of the most important stories of our lifetime, veteran healthcare reporter Shefali Lufter recently wrote. At its center, she says, the story of abortion is about medical care and what happens when that care is denied. She wrote, quote, it's tempting to focus on the political battles, but at heart, the new reality of abortion access is about medical care and health equity. Let's analyze the media coverage of this topic now with several great guests. Kate Smith is here. She's the senior director of news content at Planned Parenthood and a former CBS News reporter who covered reproductive rights. Susan Matthews is here, news director at Slate and host of the podcast Slow Burn, Roe v. Wade. And Sarah Longwell is here, Republican strategist, executive director of the Republican Accountability Project, publisher of The Bulwark, and host of the Focus Group podcast. Welcome to everybody. Thank you all for coming on. Susan, your podcast is about 1973. It's about those decades ago. Can you compare and contrast the media coverage back then with now amid this never-ending argument?
Yeah, I want to start by saying something about those front pages that you put up. The top headline on the day after Roe v. Wade came down was actually that Lyndon B. Johnson had died, and that took precedent over the Roe v. Wade decision. And actually, the justices knew that what they were doing was going to be a big deal when they announced it, but they had no idea that it was going to be the controversy that it is now. They actually thought, Justice Blackmun said when he was announcing it, things are going to be unsettled for a little bit, but eventually states are going to adjust, and we're going to get back to just accepting this ruling. So I actually think that they'd be very surprised to see the headlines that we've seen this weekend.
That we're back here right now.
Exactly.
Sarah, you've been doing focus groups, including in the wake of the ruling by the Supreme Court. So can you give us a sense from your conversations about how important this news is or is not to the average American?
Yeah, so I did a focus group with swing voting suburban women about a week after the leak. And what was so interesting was, you know, we would ask people kind of an open-ended question. So what issues matter most to you? What's the most on your mind? And very reliably, the answer was the economy, healthcare, the economy, healthcare, inflation, the economy, healthcare. And only a couple people mentioned reproductive rights or Roe. And this was right in the wake of the leak. But when you drill down, when you ask these women directly, you know, how do you feel about Roe being repealed? even though a lot of them identified themselves as being pro-life themselves, they were very alarmed by what they saw as a government overreach, an attempt to regulate their bodies. And so what I took away from that is that it's not sort of a top-of-mind issue for a lot of these voters unless you're able to make it a high salience issue, unless you're able to sort of prosecute this case, because then people feel very strongly about it. These women felt very, very strongly about it, but it was not top of mind.
Kate, what's your reaction to that? You now work on this issue full time at Planned Parenthood. By the way, what do you do as a news director at Planned Parenthood?
That's right. What we're doing, and we have an exciting announcement soon, not yet, but what we're doing is we're basically trying to help our patients navigate through what is an incredibly chaotic time for public health. I don't think there's been a larger seismic shift of the way healthcare gets delivered in the wake of this Supreme Court decision. So what we'll be doing is helping our patients navigate through that, understand what their rights are. You know, all those Google searches that you showed. There's a lot of bad faith actors on the internet. I don't need to tell you that. So we're trying to also cut through that as well, because we know on the ground there's, you know, this fight is far from over, right? It goes to the states. So we
do
have
you
a
feel
long
like
battle.
You have competitors, so to speak, at Christian pregnancy centers who do the same job you do, encouraging people not to get abortions?
Absolutely. I mean, they have been doing this for decades. And let's level set here. Since Roe v. Wade was decided in 1973, there has been an unrelenting 49-year battle for the news you saw on Friday. So, you know, we're a little bit on our back foot, a little bit, but we're coming out there and we are competing with those people. And, you know, we have the upper hand, right? Because doctors work at Planned Parenthood. They don't work at Live Action.
Susan, let's take a big, broad question here. And I know it's a little bit unfair to be so broad, but do you think the media is slanted in its coverage of Roe v. Wade and all the aftermath? I mean, here's Kate, worked at CBS. Now she works for Planned Parenthood. Is the media as an institution biased on this issue?
I think the media is a lot of different things, but I think the main thing that I would say about this issue in particular is that support for abortion has been consistent basically since Roe v. Wade, and a majority of Americans actually want access to abortion care. And so you get into a situation with the media where there's one side that actually represents a majority view of what voters want, of what Americans want, and then you have a small minority of people who have really, really strong views on this issue, and they've been doing so many things, as you're saying, as Kate has been saying, to make their views the dominant ones, to make their views the ones at the top of Google searches, to influence the Supreme Court, to do all of this. So you have this back and forth.
So think about this in the coverage in the last couple of days. Kate, I see all these split screen images, you know, of one person who's cheering, another person who's jeering. I see tears on one side, and then I see celebrations on the other. That 50-50 split, isn't that actually misleading? Isn't that actually distorting?
Absolutely, Brian. That is a complete distortion of the facts that we know about how people feel about abortion access, and specifically the legality of abortion. We know that 8 in 10 Americans want abortion to be legal. So when you put that split screen up of, you know, one person who loves it, one person who hates it, well, that's completely ignoring
the facts. Which, to be fair, we are doing right now.
Well, where's your news director? No, I'm kidding you. But
it's all me. It's all me. I choose the videos. But I did this on purpose because I do think this actually is part of the issue. New CBS polling from your alma mater today. Abortion in your state should be what? 9% of Americans say illegal in all cases. The rest say either illegal in most cases, legal in most cases, or legal in all cases. But only 9% of Americans say it should be completely illegal in their state.
And yet, we have states that are doing exactly that. I mean, before the Roe ruling, we saw Oklahoma pass a ban on abortion at fertilization. I mean, how many Americans agree with that? It's ridiculous.
Sarah, how does this sit with you as a Republican strategist, someone who may be more tuned in to conservative media than Kate or Susan? How do you read this?
You know, I think one of the things that I've seen, you know, I've been a Republican for a long time, but ever since Donald Trump, I have watched this Republican Party radicalize and become more extreme. And I think right now there's a number of governors who are the Republican Party candidates in states like Pennsylvania with Doug Mastriano, where they believe in absolutely no exceptions in the case of rape, incest, life of the mother. And I think that, you know, the task for Democrats is really going to be sort of prosecuting that case broadly of extremism against these Republicans, because they are out of step with where sort of the average person is, who does want some restrictions on abortions, but doesn't want, you know, total restrictions on abortions. And that's what I see in the focus groups from these swing voting women. The idea of, you know, a total restriction really sits poorly with them.
So three more notes about the media coverage of this. First, let's just acknowledge Politico was right. That scoop, the scoop of the century, getting that draft majority opinion, they were right. Number two, this is really interesting and a big debate inside newsrooms. A lot of guidance went out to a lot of newsrooms this week saying, hey, journalists, be careful. Don't take sides on this. Don't post something on Twitter that you might regret. Did that happen at Slate, for example?
That certainly did not happen at Slate. Slate, I think, does not have that point of view, which I'm grateful for.
Okay, but what do you think of the newsrooms that do? The New York Times and others saying, hey, let's be very careful here to make sure we're being objective in the coverage of this issue.
So as a journalist, I obviously understand the desire to be objective in the sense that's what makes you be trustworthy. I think the other issue here is that when you think about what is happening now and the fact that what's happening now has not happened since 1973, before Roe v. Wade, newsrooms were basically run by men. The reporters were men. They didn't actually face the issue of how exactly to deal with this when it was an issue that
they just caused the problem.
Yes, it's so
all the coverage of this topic, no one ever talks about sex. They don't talk about the men in this story. It drives me crazy. Anyway, I'm sorry.
It's okay. So I just wanted to note that when the action was happening to liberalize abortion rights, it was a time when women were becoming doctors, women were becoming lawyers, and women were also becoming journalists. I talked to a woman who worked at a women's section for the Miami Herald in 1971, and she said that her beat had been the four F's: food, fashion, furnishings, and family. Mm. And she got assigned a case of a woman who was being prosecuted for manslaughter for abortion. And she was like, this is a real story. I get to approach this like a real story. And I understand it as a woman. She went and talked to OBGYNs. She did her reporting differently. So I think that this idea of like what is objective is a question that we still have to answer.
Kate?
You know, I completely understand why, if you are the dedicated reporter covering this, why you need to have, you know, objectivity both in and outside of the newsroom.
Did you?
Absolutely. I stand by that.
You did?
Yeah, because look, you know how I feel about this. I think abortion should be legal. So I tried extra hard to make sure that I was doing a lot of both sides in my journalism. And Brian, I'll be honest, I look back on some of this, I think I went a little bit too far in giving some of the anti-abortion folks more airtime and a little bit more faith, I think, than they deserved a lot of the time. Mm. But to go back to your question, if you're that reporter, it's important. But what if you're not that reporter? What if you're just a random person in the newsroom? And I think what newsrooms need to remember here is that one in four women will have an abortion in their lifetimes. So when they are telling their reporters, hey, you can't talk out about this, well, how many of those reporters are there in that newsroom because of an abortion, because they were allowed to have control over their bodies, right? Mm. So I think I think newsrooms really need to think about this and think about how, you know, the economic impact of abortion and how unfair it is that they're telling their reporters, hey, like, not for you. You can't talk out about that.
This is the big inside the newsroom debate right now, but what people can and cannot be saying online. Sarah, one more note about the media. Does the press have a giant blind spot about religion? So much of this topic is about religion. It's about a certain, and not all religion, right? Specifically Christianity. And yet I don't hear as much about that in the television coverage as I think maybe we should.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly is a key to understanding. And I think there's this sense that women are kind of monolithic and that they would all be sort of pro-choice because this is an issue that affects them. But it's funny, you know, in the focus groups, when I talk to women who voted for Donald Trump, but they were very conflicted about voting for Donald Trump. One of the number one reasons that I heard about why they chose to do it is because they were a Christian, pro-life conservative. And
yes,
that was the kind of thing that kept them voting for Republicans, even when they were very uneasy about sort of all the other baggage that came with Donald Trump. And so I think sometimes when you're not aware of how important that can be to somebody's identity, you can miss why, you know, a woman who you would assume might vote for a Democrat actually wouldn't.
Religion's a big piece of the story. I think we've got to make sure we show all of it, all of these pieces. To the panel, thank you very much. Sarah, please stick around. More with you in a moment. Important note here from the Los Angeles Times before we go to break. Rough treatment of police, rough treatment of protesters, as well as journalists by the LAPD. Pretty disturbing the way some of these reporters were treated when they were out covering the protests this weekend. After the break, we're going to have some frank talk about political violence in the U.S.,
This podcast is supported by Sleep Number. Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores? Sleep Number does that. Only Sleep Number smart beds let you each choose your ideal comfort and support, your Sleep Number setting. Sleep Number smart beds learn how you sleep and provide personalized insights to help you sleep better. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. Temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent. This week on Chasing Life...
I'm sorry that the Great Barrier Reef is no longer great, that we value Amazon much more than the Amazon, and that the waterfront neighborhood where you were growing up could be condemned by rising seas before you're old enough to apply for a mortgage.
That's my friend Bill Weir, CNN's chief climate correspondent. He's optimistic about the planet, and he's optimistic about our ability to take care of it. Listen to Chasing Life wherever you get your podcasts.
The specter of political violence is now a daily story in the United States. Every single day. Political scientists, folks who study this subject for a living, say they see lots of warning signs that it's getting worse, that the country is at risk of a downward spiral. So it's imperative for the news media to take these threats seriously. This month has seen extremists caught with riot gear near a pride parade in Idaho, an unstable man arrested near Justice Brett Kavanaugh's home and charged with attempted murder, and so many other examples. Thankfully, they usually don't boil over to physical violence, but look at this episode. It easily could have. Republican lawmaker Dan Crenshaw being harassed by far-right guys who tried to pick a fight with him. Violent imagery is the theme of this new campaign ad by disgraced former Missouri Governor Eric Greitens. He's running for Senate now and wielding a gun and saying he's going hunting for fellow Republicans who've disappointed him. It's that threat of violence that is so egregious. And it can succeed in getting people to sit down and shut up. Outside Houston, for example, an Iraq War vet and professional soccer player was going to be the grand marshal for a local 4th of July parade until conservative commentators on the web attacked her support for gun control and her comments in favor of transgender rights. She withdrew from the parade, citing threats. Here's another one from outside Asheville, North Carolina. Restaurant owner faces threats after hosting drag show. The internet makes it all too easy to intimidate others, to spread fear, and maybe cause some people to back away from the public arena altogether. We heard about that at one of the most recent January 6 hearings, how Donald Trump triggered harassment of poll workers. Some of the lawmakers investigating Trump's coup attempt have beefed up security because they are facing so many threats now. And of course, January 6 was a glaring example of political violence, people using force to try to get their way. The Supreme Court's ruling against abortion may be used as an excuse for even more unrest. Right-wing media outlets and stars have been stoking fears of left-wing mass violence, as this report notes. Fox and Newsmax warned that leftists were planning a night of rage. These banners said things like, the left is threatening violence against justices. Thankfully, that has not materialized. Protests have been almost entirely peaceful this weekend. But on Saturday, Fox naturally highlighted, quote, anarchy by pro-Roe demonstrators in Arizona. Christian pregnancy centers, places that oppose abortion and encourage women to give birth, have been targeted by vandals in several states. And right-wing outlets say the rest of the media is not paying enough attention to that. Conversely, there was the Democratic Senate candidate allegedly hit in the face by her Republican rival in Rhode Island on Friday. And in Iowa, a driver of a truck who hit abortion rights protesters. Political violence can never be treated as normal on any so-called side. But if each side only highlights criminality by the other side, where does the U.S. end up? In a downward spiral, where violence begets more violence, where it becomes normalized, and where we all suffer. Media outlets have to connect these dots. It is an essential story right now. So let's talk more about it with CNN senior political analyst Ron Brownstein, Republican strategist Sarah Longwell, publisher of The Bulwark, and Tom Nichols, contributing writer at The Atlantic. Tom, all of this violence, these threats, these ads, what do you think is causing it? What's at the core of this?
I think there's a complex relationship here between the internet, which lowers the cost of making threats that, you know, anyone sitting with their phone or in front of a desktop can simply dash off the angriest thing that flashes through their mind in a matter of seconds. I think that's part of it. But I also think two other really disturbing things are happening. One is that there are people in positions of leadership, like Donald Trump and others, who have normalized this, who have made this kind of call to violence seem like a normal part of American life. That, you know, in an earlier time, this people calling for this kind of violence, doing these stupid ads like Greitens with, you know, very menacing imagery, that would have generated a lot of public disapproval even within their own parties.
Right.
But I think at the end
of it, that's right.
Yeah, they would have been. I mean, shame, you know, serves a function in public life. And now we have become, certainly people like Greitens and others, just a shameless society in that regard. But also, I think there are people now gravitating toward violence because they think it will give their lives meaning, because they want to be involved in the great drama of events. You saw this with the guy that was going after Justice Kavanaugh. He said point blank, I was looking for meaning in my life. And I think that there are more of those folks out there than we might want to believe. You saw that with a lot of the January 6th people. You know, I wanted to be part of something important. I wanted to be at the center of major events. And that makes people very vulnerable to calls for violence.
Very interesting. Let's put up on screen data from the Center for Strategic and International Studies. They found that in 2020, most attacks, political violence related to demonstrations, were conducted by violent far right perpetrators. In 2021, most of the attacks were orchestrated by violent far left individuals. I imagine the situation, Sarah, where it just gets worse and worse. The right sees what the left does. The left sees what the right does. Those partisan outlets only cover what the other side is accused of doing. And so we go down this downward spiral. Does this come up with you in your focus groups with voters? Does this come up in your coverage of the Bulwark?
All the time. I mean, one of the most sort of pernicious impacts of political tribalism is the inability to hold your own side accountable and to think that the problem is always on the other side.
Right.
So whenever I ask Republican focus groups about, you know, the violence on January 6th, the answer always, inevitably, is what about the Black Lives Matter protests? You know, what about all the left-wing violence, them showing up at judges' houses? And so they'll say something like, the one time it was Republicans, you know, everybody focuses on it. And so there's this sense of being able to sort of excuse your own side while saying the problem is really on the other side. And I think that as long as we do that, as you note, you're in this kind of vortex of backlashes where people treat violence on their own side as like a one-off and violence on the other side as embedded in the culture of what that side is.
Exactly. That's exactly what I'm seeing happen in partisan media. Ron, I think this relates to your most recent column for The Atlantic. It's titled, America is Growing Apart, Possibly for Good. Tell us, you published this a few hours before the Supreme Court decision. And then the Supreme Court decision reaffirmed it, because now there is a big glaring difference between blue states and red states that didn't exist as dramatically before.
Yeah.
Haven't you been writing these columns for decades, though, Ron?
Yeah. Yes. Well, I've been writing about the widening gap between red and blue America, certainly for 15, 20 years. And for the last decade, I think after the 2012 election, I wrote about the coalition of transformation and the coalition of restoration, which essentially is that the fundamental dividing line in our politics is between those voters in places who welcome the way the country is changing demographically, culturally, economically, and those who fear it and feel marginalized by it. And the big story, Brian, is that, you know, if you look at 20,000 feet for the middle decades of the 20th century, at a broad level, America was converging. The differences were narrowing between what we now think of as the red states and the blue states, both in terms of the opportunities for their citizens and especially for the rights that everybody enjoyed. Now we are clearly moving in the opposite direction. And Roe is the symbol of what I believe is a fundamental attempt by the axis of Republicans controlling the red states, the Republican majority on the Supreme Supreme Court and Republicans wielding the filibuster in the Senate to reverse, erase, roll back the rights revolution of the 1960s, which, you know, started with the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, the one man, one vote decision, Griswold on contraception, interracial marriage, abortion, later same-sex relations and marriage, basically reducing the ability of states to constrict and roll back and restrict fundamental national rights. We are now clearly moving in the opposite direction toward an era of what I call the great divergence between red states and blue states. But even that, I think, is a way station. I think the evidence is overwhelming that this axis, their goal is to impose the red state program on the blue states as well, and to bring us to a point where these values drive national policy on abortion and civil rights and other issues, whether or not there is majority support for them. And that's, of course, how it ties into Trump's efforts to overturn the election.
Right. The divergence, this pulling apart. Conservatives talk about a national divorce. That's the context for what we've gone through this week with the Supreme Court. Sarah, I think I might lose your satellite feed in a couple minutes, so I want to ask you a question before the break about a slightly different topic. We've been talking about your focus groups, and you have a really interesting finding from one of your focus groups about Donald Trump. Tell us what you found about the 1-6 hearings and what those voters are paying attention to.
Yeah, look, going into the 1-6 hearings, I think one of the big questions was, would it matter? You know, would it break through to voters? And I found two things that I thought were really interesting in the two Trump voting focus groups that we did after the hearings began. The first one was that people knew that the hearings were happening, you know, and that's not always the case. I remember when, you know, the Kevin McCarthy tapes leaked and everybody in Washington was talking about it. And I went into the focus groups the next day and said, what do you guys think about the Kevin McCarthy tapes? And everyone gave me blank stares. They had no idea what I was talking about. And so everybody in these focus groups were aware of the hearing. Some people had watched part of the hearing, but they mostly thought it was a dog and pony show. You know, it was just an attempt to get Donald Trump. But the most interesting thing to me was I have done dozens and dozens of focus groups since January 6th happened. And in every single focus group of Trump voters, at least half the group has always wanted to see Donald Trump run again in 2024. He still had that committed base. Yeah. In these two groups since the January 6th hearing, zero people in either group wanted to see Donald Trump run again. And so there's the question for me is it's not that the hearings are convincing these people that they don't like Donald Trump, because they're not really watching them. But the question is, you know, it makes Donald Trump's a lot to defend. And it sort of reminds people, A, that he will not let this 2020 thing go, which I think is becoming sort of boring and tiresome to some people. And also, they want to move past the conversation about January 6th. And so I think for some voters, that also means moving past Trump. And it helps, I think, for Republican voters, because I've been pretty skeptical of this Trump's grip, you know, is slipping on the GOP. But I do think it helps that there are other people, other candidates that these voters are excited about. You know, they're really excited about Ron DeSantis. They like Kristi Noem and Tim Scott. And so they've got people that maybe they want to move on to. And so I think that's also playing a role.
I think we might remember this conversation a year from now. Let's find out. Sarah, we're going to let you go get brunch. More with Tom and Ron in just a moment. And later this hour, a really important story, a follow-up to the death of Ukrainian photojournalist Max Levin. His partner is going to join us live with new information about his death.
The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish. There's been a ton of writing about the album Cowboy Carter since it dropped this spring. But what grabbed my attention is a new documentary on CNN called Call Me Country, Beyoncé and Nashville's Renaissance. Lots of artists have tried to boot scoot their way onto country music charts. Why did this album cause such a stir? And what about both this pop star and this political moment has caused all this conversation? Listen to The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish, on your favorite podcast app.
This month's January 6th hearings have wrapped. The proverbial show will continue in July. Donald Trump's media allies say these are show trials. And worse, there's all sorts of name-calling, but Fox notably did show the daytime hearings live. Of course, throughout the rest of the media, you've seen this hearing going viral, short clips on social media. The committee's tried to be very media-savvy about the way it has rolled all of this out. But there's still a nagging question about how much has broken through to the average American, left, right, center, or whatever. Let me show you some fascinating ratings charts that tell a story about the state of the country and about television viewership. This is June 16th. The red line is Fox. You see the ratings decline when the hearing starts to air. The ratings snap right back to normal when the hearing is over. On the other hand, viewership for both CNN and MSNBC dramatically increased during the hearing. Here's another example. This is June 23rd. These are even more detailed minute-by-minute ratings. You see there, up and up and down, Fox declines dramatically. The audience craters when the hearing is on. But then all the viewers come back at 5 p.m. for that 5 p.m. talk show because Fox went back to regular programming. So that's the reality, right? Fox's audience turns off the hearings. And yet, as Sarah Longwell said in an earlier block, the information does seem to be seeping through. Her impression from focus groups with Trump voters is that information from the committee's findings is reaching Trump supporters. Let's talk more about this with back with me, Tom Nichols, contributing writer at The Atlantic, who recently wrote about Trump voters' voices, and Ron Brownstein, a senior editor of The Atlantic and a senior political analyst for CNN. Tom, your headline, The Atlantic, was, "What are Trump supporters so afraid of?" Tell me what you were trying to get at there.
Part of the problem, and this links back to what we were talking about with political violence, is cognitive dissonance is really a difficult thing to bear. And what they're afraid of is being confronted with the reality of what happened, the reality of Donald Trump, and in his own words, and Trump officials in their own words, basically affirming to them that they've been lied to, that they were conned, that they were taken to the cleaners. This makes them really uncomfortable, and they will turn off the television, shout down conversations, just react with anger, because that's kind of a normal human thing to do when you find out how wrong you've been. And I think that's one of the things they're afraid of in this whole period. Where Congress is just, instead of speechifying, Congress is just saying, okay, here's Bill Barr, here's Ivanka Trump, here's, three of the top guys in the Justice Department. It's really hard for them to bear, and I think it makes them deeply uncomfortable and provokes them to anger.
Interesting. Ron, having watched all these hearings, do you feel that the committee did enough to convey this was a present tense and future story, not just about one bad day in January, but an ongoing threat? Did that message come through?
I think it came through about Donald Trump, that Donald Trump is an ongoing threat to American democracy. I think it's hard, the committee has not tied in what he is doing to what's happening in the red states with the rollback of voting rights, and even more threateningly with the legislation that enables more partisan manipulation and interference in the tabulation of votes. You know, it's interesting, this question of whether the committee is reaching enough Republican voters. Look, we know from polling very consistently over the 2 years, over the 6 years, since Trump emerged, roughly 75% of Republicans are firmly in his camp. I mean, but there are 20 to 25% of Republicans, depending on the question, who deny that the election, who disagree that the election was stolen, who believe that Trump does bear a lot of culpability for the January 6th attack, and also who even say that he should be prosecuted. Those voters have enormous potential leverage in the Republican Party. I mean, the voters who do not support the direction, the anti-democratic direction that the Trump faction is taking the party, if they basically said, I am not, willing to go down this road, there would be a lot more pressure on Republican elected officials not to do so. But the fact that they are willing to give their votes to Republican elected officials who enable and support and drive forward, operationalize Trump's big lie, basically means that all the pressure in the party comes from one side, comes from the Trump side. And that is, I'm sure if she was here, she would say that for Republican voters who feel that Trump is taking the party in a dangerous direction, an anti-democratic direction, a racist direction, they would say, well, the Democrats are a bigger problem, so I still have to vote for Republicans. We saw that from Rusty Bowers, who's saying he would vote for Trump. Until those voters who disagree with this direction, who disagree with the anti-democratic actions, take action, the party will continue to move in a Trump direction.
Ron and Tom, thank you both. Good to see you both. Up next here, a loved one pursuing the truth about her partner's death in Ukraine, covering the news. One of the many journalists killed since Russia's invasion of Ukraine is Max Levin. The photojournalist and videographer was working for a Ukrainian news site when he went missing in March. He was found dead 2 weeks later, along with a soldier he was traveling with. A new report is shedding light on the moments leading up to his death, with disturbing details that paint a picture of the horrors that media outlets have faced while covering this war, just like civilians all across Ukraine. Here to discuss this is Levin's partner, Zarina Stelmach, who participated in this new investigation by Reporters Without Borders. Thank you for coming on. I'd love to know what you think viewers should know about Max and why he was there, wanting to document this war.
Max has documented war, you know, since 2014. He was always telling the people, he wanted the people around the world knew what is going on. So, I mean, there was, you know, no wonder that when the big invasion began at 24 February, he was in the, I would say, the hottest place where the biggest battle was going on. So, like, he really wanted to know, to show people, right, that it's Russia who invade Ukraine, and that there's Russian soldiers, and they also, he wanted always to show that we only defend ourselves, that our soldiers, it's just the people who defend their families, friends, and land. That's,
yeah. The new report from Reporters Without Borders found that he was executed in cold blood. The report says, quote, the evidence against the Russian forces is overwhelming. CNN has not independently verified this information. But this report coming out, I know you were involved in its production. You also wanted to see the photo of his body. How has this been for you to learn about these findings?
It's hard. I don't know really what else to say, but it seems, feels like I really wanted to know what happened. It's like bothering me because at the time, at 2nd of April, when I got information that the body was found, I mean, the friends of ours, they showed me the one picture. It wasn't really, you know, clear because they didn't want me to see that. But still, like, in general, I think I saw that. And I was, like, surprised why it looks like that. I mean, why his body looks like that with a, like, with the glasses, as you read the report, and with no bulletproof vest. So it was really a lot of question about that. And it seems like I really wanted to know what happened exactly there. It's, you know, nothing really changed, but it's still like really meaningful for me, like personally.
He sacrificed so that we could see the truth. And I hope that learning more about his death has given you some closure. Thank you very much for coming on the program and talking with us.
Okay, thank you.
We're out of time here on TV. We'll see you at reliablesources.com and right back here again this time next week.
When you work next level. When you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.